So you guys ready to start? My name's Erica, and if anyone is not okay with it, I just want to let you all know that they're going to record this for the archives, so if you don't feel comfortable, just let me know. But my name's Erica, and this is the Radical Childbirth Workshop. I trained as a doula and did research on doulas and stuff. I'm a volunteer. Just started volunteering at a birth center. But this is just kind of a rough introduction for like different the history of childbirth and different pain relief measures and things like that. So I was thinking for the go around, we could just say where we're from and what you were your name, where you're from, and what you were hoping to get from this workshop.
My name's Dylan. I'm from Maryland, and I'm not sure what I'm gonna get from this workshop.
My name's Caleb. I'm from Western Massachusetts, and I mean, I don't really have like any huge expectations of what you're going to cover or anything, but I just like think about motherhood a lot, so just general interest, I guess.
I'm Katie. I'm from Maine, and there's nothing in particular, really, just the general topic seems very interesting. So.
I love you too. I'm Sue, and I'm from New Jersey. And I just want to hear what you have to say. Since I've been there, I probably should have known a lot of this a long time ago.
Okay, well, I was just going to start off with a little true and false. So I'm going to read out a statement, and then if you guys want to guess, just shout out if it's true or false. The first one is over 1 in 3 women will have a C-section in America.
True.
That's true, and the actual recommended rate, so we're at like 33% of all childbirths are C-section. The recommended rate from like the World Health Organization is like 5 to 10 normally, so we're more than triple that currently, which, you know, since it is a surgery, obviously that opens up more risks. Each year, over 7% of women in the world experience pregnancy-related complications that can lead to a long-term illness or disability. Right, and so that is true. And the three main factors that affect a woman's ability to receive proper care are delay in reaching care, getting adequate treatment when she gets it, and being able to afford it. Yeah. Okay, so we just started, but since Vinci, if you want to, we did a drawing just our names and what we hope to get from the workshop. You guys want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Candy. I'm working in childcare with people in the creative circle. So just to be a small bit child.
Nick, just information, kind of just an idea of some of the alternatives available, but I'd like to hear perspectives.
I'm Andrew, and I'm taking a class on gender and sexuality, and have to go to some event that relates to the course themes.
My name's Kate, and I'm a student midwife and anarchist.
Awesome. And just so you all know, too, this is being recorded, so if you feel uncomfortable. Okay, so we're starting off with a little true and false, so we can just continue if we got one or two done. But okay, so roughly 1/3 of low-income Latina immigrants of reproductive age are uninsured and therefore less likely to get prenatal and child care. Is it true or false?
Sounds like it would be false because it's low.
Right. Yeah, I would say more.
Yeah, it's actually 56%, so over half. And the risk of dying during childbirth is greater here than in here, meaning the U.S., than in 40 other countries, which would put the U.S. at the bottom of the developing world. Do you guys think that's true or false?
It's true.
That is true. So. Probably know this one. Only 6 states have statutes regarding the use of restraints on pregnant women. I'm sorry. Only 6 states have statutes regarding the use of restraints on pregnant women who are incarcerated. Is that true or false?
True.
It's probably true.
So there's only California, Illinois, New Mexico, New York, Texas, and Vermont. Those are the only ones that have any regulations at all. So it doesn't specify what those are, but otherwise it's legal to do that. So if there's a pregnant woman who is currently incarcerated giving birth, they are able to chaperone her.
And frequently do so.
Exactly. Charges for childbirth in a hospital range on average from $7,000 to $16,000, depending on, you know, what kind of childbirth you're having. Whereas by contrast, out-of-hospital births are about half of the charges. Yeah,
it's false. It's cheaper to have a home birth than that. Yeah.
Right. It's actually about a quarter for home birth. So it's about around 1,000 to 2,000 for home birth, versus like what would be the lower end of a hospital, about 7,000. So it is actually a lot cheaper, and that can, you know, complications with that in terms of access can vary. Like, if you can't afford a hospital birth, you have to have a home birth, or if you'd like to have a home birth with Medicaid, if you're on Medicaid, that won't cover a midwife or something like that. So those are just the varying aspects of accessibility in that sense. So practicing home birth midwifery is legal in America?
Yeah.
What's the?
Well, it's technically illegal in many places, but they make it so impossible that many people can't practice.
Right. And it's actually only 37 states that it's legal in. And then, like you said, the catchy point is giving birth outside of a hospital may be legal, but midwives assisting in certain cases would get in trouble. So there's that gray area there.
They can only assist in a hospital?
Yeah. And it depends on the state.
That's CPMs. Nurse midwives are able to practice home, hospital, or birthing center nationwide, legally. It's just, but then everything else that's outside of nurse midwifery, which are very, very constrained by the burden of malpractice insurance and finding a backup physician to sign.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And about 30% of hospitals in the U.S. have policies regarding whether or not mothers can have a vaginal birth after C-section. That one is true. So, like it says, 30%, so about a third of hospitals in the U.S. will regulate whether or not a woman has that option after she has a C-section, that she can try to have a vaginal birth next time. So, you know, regardless of the reasons why someone may have a C-section the first time, if they do want to try a vaginal birth the second time, they can have a lot of obstacles and burdens to overcome just to have that option. And the last one that I have here is, it is illegal to not allow women to breastfeed at work. Is that true or false? So that one's false. There's actually no federal law that protects it, so just a broad law in terms of protecting a woman's right to breastfeed while she is at work. So.
Do you have any stats on cases where
that? I don't have stats. I was trying to look for that. Different states actually have different laws, and it can vary from workplace to workplace and how specific it is. So some could say, like, some can even specify, like, you have to have a nursing room, whereas others are just like, you can't stop someone, but not actually make it easier.
Yeah, it's not necessarily illegal, but if you don't provide a place for someone to breastfeed,
right.
It's kind of
hard to
keep. Yeah.
Cool, so I guess from here, I kind of wanted to just do a broader general history of childbirth in America. I think especially since I'm sure all of you come from different backgrounds and knowledges around us, so if you have anything that you want to add, please do. But just as an exercise to start, I know this is kind of vague, but if you guys have any just general conceptions of childbirth, like what words pop to mind, what's your image of it, if you want to just raise your hand and shout something out, just kind of what you think of childbirth. for surrounding children.
No, I don't need to say.
Okay.
So, do you have a kid?
Yes, I do have a kid.
No, I, well, being from way, well, not that far back, I have a kid. I learned through some of this that there was a lot of options that I would never have known was available. Because we just listened to what the doctor told us, and probably wasn't always good. Mine worked out well. Like I said, fortunately, I had a doctor that wasn't big on, you know, a lot of unnecessary procedures. But looking at and learning a lot now, there's a lot that I should have known. There's a lot more freedom that you should have and choices that they don't really tell you about. You just kind of trust that and go with what they're telling you. So to have options that I wasn't aware of is a very important thing. So you guys have that option to do that. So don't understand.
The word that comes to mind is potential. I think that childbirth can be potentially like a very empowering experience for some people. It's done in a way that gives someone power and like allows them to feel like they gain it themselves. But I think it can also conversely be a really disempowering experience. And it can almost be kind of that last experience of not being able to do something that you wanted to do, or not being able to make a decision that was your right to have. Rhonda, especially like I think because you're engaged with so many institutions often with children, that it can be an exercise in an institution, you know, exercising power over your body, and one of the most like fundamental points and like at times in your life as well. So.
Something that comes to my mind is just like this idea of doctors like having more, like usually male, having more expertise over your own body and like telling you what is like the right thing for you to do. And yeah.
Because I'm never going to actually experience it.
Yeah.
That's what I always said. It's like they would be an expert just so far, but they're never going to give birth, so they can't really know what's just my opinion. So you know your own body.
It's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of similarities between this and other problems with healthcare. The same problems exist in a lot of other fields. So lessons learned here can go more broadly, and lessons learned in other areas of healthcare can apply to childbirth in terms of holistic alternatives.
Into my own conversation, but actually my job relates to abortion care, so there's kind of the spectrum of seeing abortion and childbirth also as on the continuum of what choice is, and having options is something that I think about a lot.
I know several women who planned on having their births certain ways and because of complications were forced into a route that they didn't want to go. Like that can be a really painful experience if you're forced to have a hospital birth and it's not what you wanted in the first place, just because your baby's 3 weeks late and needs to get out. So I feel like it's very important that we're able to decide how we want to do it, and that it can be really traumatizing when you don't have control over something you thought you were going to.
I would describe childbirth in the United States and historically as the time of the battleground over the power of women's bodies. And so clearly to me it's so impacted by class and by race and by education level, and how educated women have so many more opportunities to, like you said, have a water birth or hire a doula and, you know, really know their options. Whereas if you don't have access to that literacy, health literacy, if you don't have access to other women around you who've had these like really transformative magical experiences, and everyone else you know just went to the hospital and got, you know, waited for 3 hours for their clinic visit with, you know, whether it's a midwife or a doctor, and got shuffled along the baby factory. because it's very much just about like pushing women through, you know, on their timetable. I really see, and it's so interesting how historically across, you know, throughout the United States history, much less global history, the practices that we've used in childbirth have really accurately reflected the position of women within society and how much care that we, you know, whether we value them or not. Like right now we have technological oppression during childbirth because we live in a technological society. You know, in the 70s they just tied you down. You
know. Quite literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a great way to put it. And it's just kind of a synthesis of like, this is what I'm hearing is just systems of patriarchy and dealing with institutions, emotional aspects where it can be traumatic, and then also just since it is a capitalist thing, you know, kind of going through the factory, not actually laboring yourself, not having your labor appreciated, and then quit, and you are paying for childbirth. So I think you all brought up really great points. And I guess to jump off from what you're saying, just kind of a general history, you know, since childbirth wasn't always like this in America, in America in particular, since we can try our best to speak for ourselves, but with...
Can I interrupt you guys for 1 second?
Sure.
Can we just pass around a few of the evaluation forms for let us know what we did good or bad this year, how we can make next year better? Just for later. Thank you.
Not later.
So yeah, I mean, originally, most places, childbirth was a social event. From the limited accounts, historical accounts that we have in America, a lot of times a woman would call for her midwife when she went to labor, would have female friends who had already been through the experience come over, they would labor together, help her. It wasn't that she was isolated. She was part of a community, and she was able to give birth that way. And then slowly, as obstetrics came about, it was a struggle between primarily wealthier male doctors taking the knowledge that midwives had and trying to deem it invalid, and saying that they had this special scientific knowledge, they knew what was best, and if you cared about your baby, if you cared about yourself, you would go to the hospital. There was a lot of kind of smear campaigns, so to speak, about midwives would use a lot of racialized imagery with either Jewish or Italian midwives or African-American midwives saying, like, do you want this person to give birth to your baby? And just kind of portraying them as dirty or stupid or unknowledgeable. Whereas at the same time as obstetrics was developing into what we know to be now, you know, a lot of the practices that we currently have come from this earlier time period in like the early 1900s where, you know, women would be in the hospital bed, laying on your back is actually a result of the male obstetricians were, since they were wealthy, they had nice clothes, they didn't want to get on the ground to see. So being up in the hospital bed, laying flat, was easier for them to see. It has nothing to do with whether or not that's the best position in which to give birth, which it's actually not, because it constricts the pelvis. The concept of childbirth being this really dangerous thing is partially attributed to the fact that before people knew about germ theory, doctors would check dead bodies in the morgue and then go perform pelvic exams and not make the correlation between infection from the two because they weren't washing their hands. And a lot of women did die in that time period, and that's kind of a stigma that stayed with us. And then as we progressed into the 50s, like you were saying, early on, a lot of feminists were arguing for pain-free childbirth because they didn't. The argument was that women were kind of stuck with
sounds like a good. Yeah.
you know, as so feminists were kind of arguing for women to feel independent from their bodies, because for a lot of history, women have been forced to give, you know, expected to give birth. We're kind of stuck, you know, not having much power over our bodies, essentially. And this was a way to become freer from it.
Yeah, maybe lifting the headset will allow you to push the button.
Pushing for anesthesia in childbirth, which eventually women, because of some of the effects of the drugs that they were using, women would actually thrash around. So they did tie women down while they were giving birth because it was dangerous, and a lot of times people wouldn't even remember their childbirth, and it was just another way of kind of co-opting a female experience. You know, a patriarchal medical system was imposing this on women. It was in like the 1960s and 70s, we had the natural birth movement and more of a resurgence of American midwifery. But at the same time, even as this knowledge was being disseminated, there was still an increase in medical interventions. So we're still here today where we have a lot of these practices that are standards of care that are actually detrimental. And the knowledge is out there that they aren't the best things to do during childbirth in terms of, you know, a more satisfying childbirth where it's healthier or better for the woman. The information's there, it's not being practiced. So we have these, so we're not doing things effectively while still continuing to not give women the room for options and for choice, like you were saying. So I guess I wanted to do a quick run through, if people are okay with this, just kind of different vocabularies for these kind of standard practices in childbirth today in hospitals, to make sure everyone's familiar with the language. I don't know, do y'all feel that would be helpful or necessary? Okay. So if you want, I can just say terms if you want to answer. If you know, go ahead. If not, I have, you know, what I wrote down. But basically, you go into labor, and the vast majority of American women, like 98%, give birth in hospitals. So if you go into labor, you go to a hospital, one of the first things they do, and this kind of introduces us into a theory that's often called viewing childbirth as a pathology. So you go and then you act like you're sick, so you're in a wheelchair quite often. And when you get there, they may introduce an IV, which is kind of a precautionary thing. Just in case you need a C-section, they have the IV. It's not actually necessary. They just say it's just there. It's easier because it's already prepared. At the same time, it keeps you from being able to walk around. It keeps you from, you know, having the option to be mobile, which does help with labor. Same with eating and drinking. If you're in a hospital, primarily they're going to be giving you ice chips in case they have to put you under. They don't want you to choke is the reason. But at the same time, if you're giving birth, you do need energy, you may get hungry. Some women don't get hungry once they get to a later part in labor, you don't want to eat, but you know, as you're laboring, it's helpful to, you know, have those options if you're hungry, if you need juice, if something like that, as opposed to ice chips for like 48 hours and then needing to, you know, push. So one thing that I don't know if you all are familiar with the electronic fetal monitor. Does anyone know what that does? Or
it increases the amount of interventions without on low-risk women without increasing without decreasing the infant or maternal morbidity or mortality, which means it's a bad use of technology. Although it's very useful for high-risk women, but it's been expanded to be used for all women. It's two little monitors that they put on your belly with a band around it, and one of them is a fetal heart monitor, and the other one measures contractions. So then it makes a nice little strip on the screen that lots of family members like to sit around and go like this, instead of focusing on the woman, which is, you know, they don't know better. I haven't done it before. And,
Should we shut a door back there?
They can monitor.
Can I do that?
I think is it coming from above?
I think it might be coming from above.
Yeah.
Coming in.
Exactly.
But it's a, you know, it's a technology.
Right. And yeah, and it's the same thing. It does often lead to more interventions. A lot of women complain, like, a nurse will come in and not ask how are you feeling? How are your contractions? They go directly to the monitor to look at the strip of what the output is. And it takes away from the personal experience of childbirth and being... in your body. It's kind of taking you outside, people looking at technology, not seeing the personal experience as valid. And sometimes they misread, and you know, it's useful if there are complications. You can see them, but having it on everyone, sometimes they misread, sometimes it leads to more interventions earlier than necessary or before, or if they're not necessary at all. If you're induced, you generally have to have, you don't have to, but you know, an induction is when, like you said, your friend was 3 weeks late, I think. And they, so I don't know if you want to talk about this at all. Do you think you have induction?
Well, she was either 2 or 3 weeks late, and she'd had, she was going to give birth in a hospital, but she wasn't going to do an epidural or any of those things, but because she needed to not be pregnant anymore, they induced labor.
Yeah, basically they typically use Pitocin. They may soften the cervix. Pitocin is a synthetic hormone. It's oxytocin is the hormone for labor. Your body can regulate itself. Pitocin induces contractions, but it doesn't do it in kind of a rhythm where your body would kind of, you know, you have a contraction and it goes up and down. Pitocin's kind of constantly contracting, so it's a lot more painful. And typically for, you know, it's a 40-week gestation, generally, most doctors and midwives sometimes won't even let you go beyond 42 weeks, and it varies reasons why. You know, you can do stress tests to see how the baby's doing, but if they induce you, generally, you're gonna, if you do Pitocin, it's a lot more painful. A lot of people, you know, people may try to do it without an epidural, but it's difficult because you... The words people have used that I've heard is getting on top of your contractions, because there's no rhythm to get used to. It's hard to deal with the pain. And an epidural, you know, is another word just if everyone's familiar with. It's a pain relief, medical pain relief. It numbs you from the bottom down. Now they can fine tune it a little bit where you can feel some things, but obviously you can't move. You're in bed. Sometimes it's hard for women to feel contractions sometimes, so if you've had an epidural, you may need to be told when to push. It's also a little bit harder to push, so there's different ways.
Well, so if it's, does it actually paralyze?
I believe so. Do you know that if it technically...
There's a catheter that's introduced into the epidural space of the spine, and it, they put in... I'm pretty sure it's a, you know, some type of... opiate that numbs you. Yeah, it numbs you from the from about here down. Sometimes it can go a little bit higher, and people get real scared because it can, and, you know, you feel like you can't breathe. But that's a really rare complication. It's mostly just from here down. But yeah, you can't move. You can't feel, and you can't move.
If you can't move, how are you contracting?
The muscles will still contract.
Yeah, your smooth muscle still acts on its own. You just can't control the there's two kinds of muscles, and there's a kind that you can control, like when your arms move like this, and then there's a lot of other muscles in your body, like digestion, that you don't have like conscious control over.
Yeah,
so you can't like move your legs like this. But
similar to paralysis from the neck down, the heart still beats generally. Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, one way of like, since you can't move the muscles, the voluntary muscles, and women will kind of do sit-ups almost to push it out.
That's actually incorrect. I'm sorry. I take all that back. You just can't feel it. You can, all the muscles still work. Because obviously, because you have voluntary control over the pushing muscles that you push out the baby with. And you just can't feel it all. That's what it is.
They kind of have to tell you when you push.
Yeah,
because you can't feel when the contraction's coming.
So that's how you went. You push now. So you don't have that experience of, you know, you'll get an urge to push, but if you have a contraction, that urge isn't there because you can't feel it.
That's a bit very different. I didn't have it. Really, no one to have a push, so it has to be very, disconcerting to trust them to tell you when to push. You'll know when you're not under anything. You just know what you have to do. That's different.
And the epidurals can lead to, you know, with any medication, obviously there can be complications. Sometimes the epidural will slow down labor, and then there's kind of this cat and mouse game of, you know, if you have Pitocin, then you get the epidural, then they need more Pitocin, and then you need more dural, and then that can lead to distress, and then it can lead also to C-section once the baby goes into distress. So there's kind of this circle and cycle of medications and interventions feeding off of each other in these instances. And on that note, C-section, I'm sure everyone's familiar with what that is. There's obviously, like we said before, there's a really high C-section rate in America. I know, last I checked, I know New Jersey had the highest in the states. So, and obviously with any surgery, there's complications. There can be complications with breastfeeding and bonding. And obviously it's difficult with language around that because it's not to say that women who have C-sections don't bond with their children. There's certain hormones, though, when a baby passes through the vaginal canal that they kind of interplay, and when you have a C-section, those aren't passed to each other.
What is the rate?
The national rate? It's 33%, I think, now. And it should, the World Health Organization recommends 5 to 10. So it's really high here. You know, obviously with a C-section, it's alone. A lot of women talk about the room being cold. So it's just kind of this compilation of feelings and experiences also in addition to just having surgery, the way you feel about your childbirth and how you're interacting. When you become a passive person in your childbirth. So it's, once again, that where that can be also emotionally hard for women who don't want to have a C-section, who weren't expecting to, or just didn't need one but had one.
Well, and if you look at the rate of 5 to 10% being the recommended one, there's a lot of people getting unnecessary C-sections. And a C-section is a very valuable thing when you need it. Thank you for every obstetrician that, you know, knows how to do that amazing skill. The unfortunate thing is that we're, you know, encouraging many, many people to go under unnecessary massive surgery. And there's impacts on the baby too. You know, they can oftentimes have more trouble breathing, which isn't so much of an issue if it's like a really necessary procedure. But if you're unnecessarily having, you know, this intervention that makes the mother's healing time take longer, it separates the mother and baby from the, you know, initial period of bonding, oftentimes separates the family from the mother, unless it's like a more modern facility and they actually let the father in the operating room. Like there's, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. And even just the concept of having an elective cesarean is kind of strange and new. And it is a surgery that's supposed to be an emergency thing. But now it's just kind of an option. And often that option.
Plan exactly when you're going to give birth. Be able to go back to work. Because a lot of people have stuff that's, like now, like I work with a lot of people my generation, because the knowledge isn't out there. You need to go and spread the word. They don't have
that. You know, obviously, that becomes a fascinating as well. You're able to even schedule the C-section, or your doctor's not going to respect your choice. So those are just kind of... Yeah, so this, that was the basic vocabulary I wanted to go over with anyone. Is there any questions? Do you feel like there's anything that's missing? I don't know. Anyone wants to add anything just before we move on?
A suggestion?
Yeah.
If we move this here and I'll move forward a little bit and then we can hear each other better. We can get cozy.
So, I just wanted to pose a question to everyone, but or I guess just to have everything laid out on the table and talking about childbirth as kind of on the spectrum of choice. What options do women have in terms of giving childbirth? Where, how, who? I guess what options do we have?
You mean what options can we have, or what options
do we have? Can we? Yeah.
You know, most women could give birth at home if they chose to, but there's not as much support for that. Health insurance doesn't always cover it. Your family might think you're crazy. So most of your choice is having a person.
Yeah, so if, and there's even, and I'm, you know, stigma with going with a midwife instead of an OBGYN, because people think that, you know, midwives don't know what gynecologists know, but obviously, you know, the thing that gynecologists have is they know how to do surgery. That's the C-section. So that's what they're there for, is for the high-risk cases. There's also birth centers, which I know in this area there's very few, which can be helpful for women who maybe don't want to give birth at home and want that option, but also don't want to be in a hospital where there's all these standards of what you have to go through.
Can you explain the difference between a birthing center and a hospital, how they're different?
Right, so they're usually run, you usually go with a midwife at a birth center. They have, just decor-wise, they're generally different, where it's more of a homey atmosphere, so there's bed. I know the one that I volunteer at has, you know, showers, bathroom, bed. It almost looks like a bedroom. And you can have, generally you can have family and friends there. Whereas, and it's not home, so there's kind of, you know, that stability if you feel like, you know, you need to have other medical technologies available to you. And a lot of times they are affiliated with the hospital. Sometimes they're in hospitals, which is kind of complicated because then they don't necessarily act as a freestanding birth center, where they do have hospital policies kind of imposed on them, and it makes it more difficult. Whereas in the hospital, it's, you know, I'm sure, like, a hospital room, kind of cold. There is all the technology. It's hard to fight against the standards of practice. It's hard to say, no, I don't want an IV. I want to be able to walk around, because technically you're allowed to, but people can give you a hard time about it, too. So. And that's where the options come in. Like, you can do that, but, like, do they really let you? And even with pain relief, I know people I've spoken with have said, a lot of times nurses will just keep coming in saying, you know, do you want your epidural yet? When are you going to get the epidural? And it's like, no, I really don't want one. And there's just a lot of pressure that keeps coming at someone.
It's such a vulnerable time in a person's life.
Right.
You're going underneath this enormous task of, like, it's like running a marathon. It's like so, it's like called labor for, right?
Right.
It's called labor for a reason. It's incredibly hard work. And then at the same time, to have like someone come in every 10 minutes like, oh, are you sure you're doing okay? I'm not sure. Are you doing okay? I'm like, well, I thought I was doing fine, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I do need an epidural.
Right.
Kind of play on your fears.
Yeah.
What's that?
I said they almost play on your fear a little bit, because it's huge and you're afraid anyway. There's not as much knowledge out there as you guys have now, that you just figure, oh, if they're telling me I need it, I must need it. So, you know, it's, when you said it's an enormous thing, but they just look at it a different way. So.
I kind of have a question related to the hospital, like the standards of care and the practices, because I do agree that I think a lot of times, I mean, just probably from like you know, their training and different interests that are involved with it, you know, hospital staff do kind of rely on the authority that they get as being part of that institution to kind of maybe force people into whatever they think is, you know, the best thing for them or for them. But I'm wondering kind of about the legal context for that too, though, and because I know some of my friends that have given birth who basically said that like they were told certain things, like we have to induce you right now, or like you have to have a C-section. And so I'm kind of wondering about like what is the legal context for women having to have C-sections or having to, you know, maybe go on Pitocin or something.
Yeah, because, I mean, malpractice is such a big issue in America for doctors, and I could be wrong about this. The last I heard was that the statute of limitations for OBGYNs was, like, 18 years, so literally, like, you could have had, you have a full-grown child, and, like, you could still hold something against the kind of, the obstetrician. I don't know if that's changed since I last heard it, but that was what I, that was what you're saying. They're using more technology because our legal system is kind of biased towards the medical system and the way they interact with each other. For example, you can get a court-ordered C-section. So if a doctor thinks it's necessary, they can go to the court and bypass the mother's decision.
That's really controversial.
Right.
There's a lot of people fighting those. I mean, it's like state by state.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, even that, the fact that it's possible is kind of crazy. And so generally, from my understanding, the perception is that if you do a C-section, you've done everything. Because, you know, the more technology, the better, and you're trying harder. So I think in many cases, doctors, the way they practice, they may not be happiest with, because there are so many ways where they have to kind of save themselves. And like, we have to have this paperwork so we can prove that we did this for you. We have to do this. We have to do that. To have the paper trail so that if anything happened.
But they don't. Yeah. They can't legally force you to. I mean, unless maybe in those cases, like, right. They can't force you to engage with any of these interventions necessarily. Or
no, I mean, yeah, right. In cases where they go to court, which is usually different, more extreme. Yes, but otherwise you can say no. It just depends on how easy or hard they make that. And some places it's just almost impossible to get them to agree to it.
You can always sign out against medical advice.
Yeah.
You can.
You can always do that, and people always have that option. And the home birth I went to, this woman, she didn't even have a midwife. She was just like, I'm not going to the hospital. And she cobbled together everyone that she knew that knew anything about birth. And I wouldn't recommend that. Mm-hmm. You should get... But, you know, people, there's always options. You know, it's just about a matter of, like, having that determination to do what you want.
Unfortunately, most folks don't feel that empowered.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
That's good to know. Yeah, like, the legal right doesn't exist there.
Okay, so I was going to talk a little bit about kind of alternatives or just, like, I guess there's kind of a bias towards natural birth, but also because that is the alternative in our culture, where medical childbirth is what is the, like, that's the main thing. That's what most people do. You go to the hospital. So the alternatives to that, I just kind of wanted to talk about. And one of the first things I know for me that came to mind was support. And having labor support with you. And I think there were very few people here when I first said this, but I had trained as a doula and did a lot of research on doulas. I don't know if everyone's familiar with that term. Does anyone need me to
explain that? I guess I need a little clarity.
Okay. So a doula is, they're non-medical professionals, so it's not like a midwife, but they're there for emotional and physical support during labor. So giving, you know, verbal encouragement, being there to give, you know, help with pain relief, so back massages, suggesting position changes and things like that. It's kind of the person who can be there to reassuringly to just let you know that everything's going okay, and kind of give a pep talk. Just scientific studies wise, people say they found that women having continuous presence during their labors often do better, whether it's faster, whether they're more likely to have a vaginal childbirth, things like that. And the speculation is that by having someone else there who's not nervous, who's just observing, even without interacting with the mother at all, it's reassuring when you look over and someone else doesn't look nervous, so you know that you're doing okay. So it relates to that vulnerability where you're like, I've never done this before, I don't know if it's right, I'm nervous, what's happening, to see someone else in the room just sitting there, not worried, makes it seem okay. And so having that support kind of helps with that vulnerability since it is such a transformative part.
Don't doulas also have help after the birth, in the first few weeks of?
There's actually three different kinds now. So I know there are actually abortion doula trainings now, but there's birth doulas who are there during labor, and then there's postpartum doulas who can. Some people get certified as lactation consultants as well. So they're there to just help out during the first few weeks, reminding the mom often to take care of herself, or helping with breastfeeding, helping around the house, and things like that. Yeah. And to touch on that, because it's interesting in America where we have this kind of formalized role now that's kind of appeared since the 80s, late 90s mostly, of the doula, and a lot of other places or in the past, that's usually based on friendship or kinship, in terms of who's there with you. And I know in hospitals it varies, but a lot of times they do have limits on how many people can be in the room. So a lot of times it's two people. So if you wanted your family with you, you may have to choose if you're in a hospital while you're giving birth.
I'm sorry, I missed, did you say in birthing centers that's not the case, usually?
Usually not, no. And obviously at home it's whoever you want. In birthing centers you can usually have as many people as you want, which depends on what the mother wants, because depends on if you want a party and there's 20 people there, or if you just want your close friends, two or three people. So
I think the emergence of the doula, I'm a doula too.
Okay. Yeah.
The emergence of the doula is, do you mind if I interject here?
Oh, no, of course.
It's such an interesting reflection on the way that modern medicine has completely eradicated our community knowledge about birth. How many people here have actually ever attended a birth that wasn't their own? Okay, so there's a lot of us here. But you probably notice among your peers, most people just don't go to each other's births or hang out around birth very much, because even when we started letting the fathers back in the L&D room, we didn't allow in all the other women in the community that are the torchbearers of tradition in most societies. It's one of the major roles of women. And so we've just modern medicine has very effectively eradicated that knowledge. It's people don't have baked bread anymore. It's not rocket science. You can bake bread, it's just nobody does it because you rely on, or wheat to bake your bread, and it's the same thing. We don't know how to provide labor support for one another because you've really never done it, And they make it seem like this really terrifying, scary thing that, we don't really know how to do, and it's we can all learn how to do this. That's my doula rant. I read this amazing article one time written by this grandmother that was doula shmoola, how about a grandma? And I was yeah, that's really what it's about. This whole professionalization of a really traditional community role is ridiculous.
And yeah, and just throw in coming at it from an anti-capitalist perspective, it's odd. It's just unique. It's unique as a cultural role to pay for labor support that often comes from a grandmother or friends and things like that, so that it is a profession that you get paid for. And I know when I was talking, I wrote an ethnography, so just interviewing and kind of extrapolating on what it means to be a doula in America. A lot of people talked about women getting paid for their work. So there's this, this sense of needing to get paid and appreciated, because, as payment being a form of value in the way we live, appreciated for the work that you're doing, which is women's work, seen as less important and that thing, but at the same time, making this a professional role, which is often not at all. It's an informal thing.
But it's also really extremely, I totally agree with what you're saying. That's really smart. I hadn't thought of that. It's also it does take a little bit of skill, and it's also exceedingly valuable. Every woman who needs a vaginal birth actually needs a doula. You really need to have a doula there with you, but they just we just don't have the knowledge anymore.
Yeah. And I guess we can even touch on it now since we are kind of talking about it, but I was going to talk a little bit about reproductive justice in relation to this kind of conversation. And I know, you know, we've mentioned a lot how a lot of these, the problems with hospital childbirth reflects the problems with the medical industry in total. But at the same time, with just doulas, which is this awesome alternative that exists now, that disappeared for a while, a lot of times it's paid for out of pocket. Most insurance companies, because of the same biases or whatever, won't pay for it. So then there's this limit of access. And if you can afford a doula, if you can afford to pay for one, if there's even anyone in your area, it may vary according to, like, if you live in a city, there's a lot more people versus if you live in a more rural area. So things like that kind of affect the accessibility of that as well.
Is there doula training? I was actually just thinking, like, in addition to family members, like, and bringing the partner, if there's a partner present, male or female, obviously, you know, into that, maybe even having the doula role, if that's an option, but, you know, just training in general. I was just wondering if that's something that's going on.
Yeah, there are doula trainings. You can get certified as a doula. So when I said I trained is when I did a training. It was like a two-day thing. And you learn different support measures. And I do have papers up there, too. I didn't point them out yet, but it's if you all wanted to pick them up either now or later, it talks about some pain relief measures, but you learn stuff like that as a doula. In terms of childbirth education, there's different natural birth classes that Bradley method is a natural childbirth method. And there's weird language because it's the husband coached childbirth, so it's really clearly, now people see it as very heterosexist, and focusing on this, who's going to be at the childbirth based on this nuclear family conception. But you know, there are classes where people bring partners and you can and you learn together, but I don't know if there's anything formalized, so to speak, about having friends and other people like learn with someone, but I think that would be cool and useful, because like you were saying, it's outside of community now, so kind of teaching each other and learning together.
I can say also, like, even just from personal experience, like, I took a doula course in Seattle at the Seattle Midwifery School, and like there was a couple other women that were doing it because like a friend of theirs was pregnant, and so they wanted to be able to be there. And like one of my interests in it too was to be able, kind of acknowledging the fact that there has been this break in information, basically, like in traditional rules of support, and like a lot of communities, and wanting to kind of relearn some of that information, because like I knew my grandma didn't know it. She didn't even breastfeed like any of her kids, that she would have been absolutely horrified to. And there wasn't a lot of that information in my community directly or within my family personally. And so just wanting to have that information available for like my friends that were gonna, you know, give birth, or like my little sister wanted to give birth, and just being able to kind of reclaim that role and like be able to disseminate that information on like an informal level. And there were some other women there that really wanted to pursue professionally, and so I think it's nice having a spectrum as well, and just maybe kind of a proliferation of that information, because I do think it just needs, more people need to know it.
Yeah, and hopefully something like this constitutes as like sharing that information as well. And I know, and kind of jumping off of what you said, I know a lot of people I've spoken with who are doulas now were like, well, I got really interested in it because my friend had me come to her birth, and like I wanted to learn more. So I don't think that reaction is uncommon. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Oftentimes say that the father of a baby is oftentimes more at least as appreciative of my work as a doula as the mother. But it's like such a valuable asset to, because it's like, if it's your first child, you feel like you're yourself being pretty emotionally overwhelmed at the time, the father usually is, and so it's really nice to have someone there that's like, oh yeah, you know, when amniotic fluid spurts out like that, yeah, that's normal, cool, you know, or whatever it is, that you're like, whoa, never seen that before. Never seen my partner, like, you know, in this, like, wild woman state that they get in.
you were able to do that with your sister, did you say?
No, no, I have a younger sister. Oh, okay. It was kind of advanced.
Okay. All right.
Too early to play that sort of thing.
Okay.
For her, especially.
Cool, and so I guess keep continuing along alternatives, you know, as in terms of alternatives and support, whereas, you know, having support may vary in hospitals. Since we talked about induction a little bit, like some things that people can do to help induce is even having sex. I've heard drinking wine, obviously limited, and you're not doing that for the whole pregnancy, but just the interactions of prostaglandins can help that. And there's a few different ways to kind of get things going. In terms of like early labor, it's kind of not encouraged, but like at the hospital, obviously. But gravity does help, and walking around and exercising a little bit, and going up and down stairs can help kind of get things going. It can be distracting for, you know, once the pain starts, but also gets things going a little bit faster because there is gravity and there is movement, and it does help. And that's, you know, one of the things, again, with being in a hospital, you're expected to just lay there for hours. And there's like, and then they have like a timetable of like how many centimeters you're supposed to dilate, you know, over time, how fast that's supposed to happen. Whereas if you're laying there, it's hard to meet that standard, especially if you're scared and you have all these things connected to you and you know what's going on. It's difficult to do and to live up to that expectation. One of the main things, though, that I guess generally is talked about in alternatives is pain relief, because childbirth is painful. Like, and it depends on how you want to view contractions, and you know, for whoever, you know, I don't know if anyone else has given birth in here. You did. It's painful.
Yes, it is.
But it's something that you can get through. It's not like women can't do it. And I think there's like you go to a hospital and people will be like, there's actually a website, and this is kind of, I almost feel like I'm going on a tangent, but it's related. It's My OB Said What, is this new website I found. I don't know if anyone else has seen it. It's kind of painful to read, but at the same time there's just like all these statements said by obstetricians, or I think they include nurses, midwives, and OBs, but just like ridiculous things said to women. And one thing, like, there's numerous ones where they're like, I don't understand these women who want natural childbirth. Like, why torture yourself? And obviously, it's more complicated than that. But, you know, having those options there is important. And there's just this conception of it being so unbearable. But women are able to do that. And like you said, women, using the word empowered, women aren't empowered to believe that we can get through that pain or work through it or maybe not have it feel like pain or maybe understand the strength of how we can get through that.
I actually had a friend show me this site, so our group, Orgasmic Childbirth, where the women actually, through their, you know, special exercises and meditation, it was actually more of an orgasmic experience where you're totally in the moment and you're focused on this pain, but it more kind of becomes this wild experience where you have like a whole body orgasm through this you know, this beautiful thing that's happening. So if anybody's interested, orgasmic childbirth, I think I found it on Facebook or something.
That's actually the person that made the movie was the person I did doula training with.
Oh, really?
And did you say you too?
This is my second training, yeah.
Okay,
I did
awesome.
With her,
yeah.
Deborah Pascali Bernard. She's amazing.
She is.
Really good film. Did you see the film?
I didn't. I only saw, there's, I know on the website there's like a trailer and you can watch it. But yeah, she showed some of it at my training, and she's someone that when she spoke, she talked, instead of calling it contractions, she talks about surges, and sometimes just different language like that helps with a conception of pain. So saying contraction sounds painful and like you have to tense up, whereas if you consider it a surge, it's just like this buildup and release, and even just naming it something different might change how you view it or what you're expecting.
if you had anything to add since Deborah.
She's great. The film is, I really highly recommend that film almost more than any other birth film for people to see, because it's not just about the orgasmic birth, because they do show one that's like blatantly she's just coming all over the place with and you're like, damn girl. But there's a lot of different women talking about their different experiences of childbirth, and it's not just like tolerate pain until your child's here and then, oh thank goodness I'm happy and a mom now. It's like, oh, I had this spiritual transformative experience, or like God came to me and angels filled up my head, or like, I don't know, I'm sure that's not a quote, but but it just explores them very many different experiences that women have and how powerful it is. And that, since not to box all experiences of childbirth into pain, you know, like that's like the only acceptable box. But a lot of people experience this pain.
Did she talk at all, or did she discover any cultural ideas related to that? Like making it a positive, totally positive, like spiritual experience?
I mean, it was a while since I've seen that film, but I don't think that she explores that so much, but that's really, really true. I mean, traditionally women have always like, like played me. Oh, I just inhaled this food. Like sang songs and like played music during birth and like dancing's like huge. Like belly dancing was initially developed to teach women how to move their hips in labor. But you gotta get that head like screwed to the pelvis so you're like moving around. There's like a ton of different ways to. There's this midwife in Tennessee. Are you gonna talk about Ina Mae Gaskin?
Yeah, I was gonna.
Okay.
If you want to. No, I didn't have it like
your
set
order.
Into here.
She's real in favor of people making out in birth because it increases the oxytocin. Mm-hmm. And so she's always like, loosen up your lips, you loosen your lips, you loosen your vagina. Go. And things like, you know, a lot of cool techniques. I believe in it.
So speaking of techniques, I'm heading out right now to just two separate sheets of different pain relief measures or different positions and stuff like that that are options during childbirth. And I don't know, I'm going to pose you all a question. I don't know if you want to like look over it and then maybe talk about things, like see if there's anything you were surprised by or just have questions about. So I feel like it may be a little redundant to just kind of read down the list. So is everyone okay with like taking the questions again and then come back? So.
I will say, in the city hospital that I'm working in right now, every woman, if I walk in the room, if I haven't been in there because I'm like the freaky doula that comes in, is lying on her back and not in any of these positions. I've seen like maybe 3 times I've walked into a room like all semester long where someone's been like laboring in a different position.
I heard it's lying in your back, that customary position that you all see on TV or whatever, that's the most uncomfortable position to give birth in. But I mean, is it just easiest because it's like in a view where the doctor can see? Is that why?
That's why we do that. Because with obstetricians, especially earlier on, I was saying a little bit before, that it was usually wealthy men, so they had their suits on and they didn't want to get on the ground. So this was the easiest way to see. And I'm, you know, related a little bit to modesty at the time as well, since it was like the Victorian era. But we just kind of continued with that, but it actually constricts the pelvis, so it's one of the most painful ways to give birth.
And it presses the weight of the fetus on the vena cava, which is like an important vein that runs behind. It's like runs in front of the spine. Mm-hmm. And with all your weights on that, that's like seriously inhibiting blood flow through the rest of the body. Yeah, it's a really not physiological choice. I think it also has to do with disempowering women too. I mean, if you've got a woman who's like upright, pushing down, that's, you know, it's just a much more powerful position than lying on your back.
Right. And just in terms
terms of giving birth, you get to use all those other muscles of, like, if you're standing and squatting, then you can use everything.
What's Rebozo?
Rebozo, it's actually, so that refers to just, it's kind of like a pashmina, a scarf, and you can use it in a variety of ways, whether it's just, like, under the hips to wrap, basically, like, the big scarf around someone's waist and, like, just support it that way. Sometimes it relieves pain. But essentially, it's a scarf. It's, I think Mexican midwives use it, so that's where the term comes from.
But it's listed here under attention-focusing strategies. So in what way does a scarf help you to have inward focus?
Is it on this paper?
Yeah.
The checklist.
Attention. Yeah, I just want to see if I can answer that the best way.
Because I was thinking with inward focus, it kind of makes sense because it's like meditation. It's like you're turning, you can turn the pain into something else. That's what I was thinking, but then I was like, what was it?
Okay. Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. Oh, I think, I don't know if this is what they're specifically referring to, but sometimes, like, women can hold onto ropes as just, like, kind of pulling back and supporting themselves. I don't know if that's what they're referring to in terms of, like, holding and kind of finding a position and sitting that way. So that's a good question, but I'm sorry, I don't have the exact answer, but yeah.
What is a purple cushion?
So with directed, it's kind of when they tell you when and for how long to push. So it's kind of a name for it, because it's not telling a woman how long she should push for and when. Doesn't kind of respect the body's natural urges and can actually be more difficult. So sometimes people, like, I think, I'm not sure where the term comes from, but with directed, I'm not sure for this, I'm sorry, but with being told for how long, sometimes people will hold their breath and, like, it's not as effective as it could be. For this, I'm not sure, same thing as what they meant. Unless it's like, I don't know if you know, but like holding, sometimes it's best to wait. It's kind of, I feel like it's kind of contradictory to say, like, sometimes you do need to wait, sometimes you don't, but midwives can often kind of tell if you have, a lot of times you will say, if you feel the urge, you should try, but you can also kind of guide people if it's a little bit too early, if they might not be ready yet in terms of kind of exhausting themselves too. So.
Do you mind if I add to you?
Yeah, go ahead. If you add.
I think what this checklist is doing is saying, like, all the different things that you could try. So beginning of bearing down, like pushing. At the beginning, it's helpful, like, up until recently, the model of how labor went was like first, second, third stage. And second stage is, you know, first stage is like from before you're in labor until you're fully dilated. And then second stage is like when you're fully dilated to when you push the baby out. And then third stage is like from when the baby comes until when the placenta comes. And traditionally what they've been doing is saying, okay, you're fully dilated, 10 centimeters, time to push, let's go. Like, let's get this baby out because now you can because the cervix is open wide enough and you might as well just get it out as fast as possible. But the new, you know, more recently, it's not even that new, but there's been a philosophy of allowing a woman to wait and allow the baby just to bear down on its own. And so giving people a little bit more time after you're fully dilated, you know, an hour or so, or till she herself feels that strong urge to push. With the epidural, a lot of times women are, because they don't have as strong of a feeling, a lot of times they've been turning the epidural, like in my hospital, they turn the epidural off at fully dilated, so then she can actually feel to push, which I think is pretty effective. But if the woman can't feel or can't coordinate or is just feeling way too out of control, which does happen sometimes, you can help her with directed pushing. And the way that they pretty much always do it, I'm pretty hands-off, and so people kind of step in a lot, where I'm like, I just thought she was doing fine, so sorry. But what you would, you know, what the nurses will do, will just tell the woman to take a big breath in and then hold it, hold behind your legs, chin to the chest, and push down. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then you take another big breath and then push down again. And you try and get three of those into one contraction. So that turns your face purple a lot of times, which is why they call it purple face push.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Is there any other parts of the sheet that you kind of want to go over? Because I was going to do a game next if people wanted to try that. You might have done this at the training, but kind of, so we're probably running a little bit lower on time, but if you all want to try the game, there's options on each side of the set of cards, and if you can't read my handwriting, just let me know, but you can choose, so the idea is to choose your ideal child group, so you can choose home birth, midwife, and if you set up with a partner, and each one of you does your ideal child birth, you then will ask each other to change three things about your ideal childbirth. And from there, if you could both have a discussion about what other things might change, it's kind of a term that's often used is the cascade of interventions, which is when you get one intervention, often another one will come, and another one. And like we were saying before, where the medicalization just kind of feeds off of each step. So I'm going to hand these out if you guys want to pair up first, and then if y'all can set up what your ideal childbirth would be, if you want to, you know, set up on the floor and just lay it out, what you would ideally have. So I'm going to hand these out.
Yeah, he's downstairs.
Oh,
he was looking
for
you guys, and
then like, people. He stepped on my
car
really fast afterwards.
So is everyone ready to wrap up?
Yeah.
That's cool. So I know we're short on time a little bit, but I just wanted to like process with everyone. I didn't get to talk as much about reproductive justice aspects as I wanted to in terms of accessibility, having access to information, access to alternatives. Do you guys want to just kind of throw out what you learned or talk about things that you think we might have missed if it is accessibility and stuff like that? Thoughts? Yeah. Do you guys have any questions or how did you feel about the exercise or did you learn? Were you surprised by anything?
Yeah. I was sharing the experience of...
You don't have to share it.
Oh, it doesn't. It's beneficial. I'm from a more small town rural area and a lot of people don't know about this and it's just you go straight to a hospital and also a lot of people give birth fairly young. A lot of people my age at 23 already have children. And she was given a C-section because her hospital visit only, her insurance only allowed her so much time in the hospital. She was taking too long. She always wanted to have a big family. The C-section did not go well. It was not completely necessary. And she was told she would probably never be able to have a vaginal birth and she may not be able to have children again at all.
So sad.
Because of complications. So, and that was her first child at 22, so.
Second opinion.
Yeah.
Op report and second opinion.
It's unbelievable how when you ask for a second opinion at a hospital or at a doctor, they just the way they treat you. Like I was in a hospital for car accident and I mean they were giving me unnecessary tests that I heard them in the hallway discussing how they're unnecessary. but when you question them, they talk to you and even call you uneducated, and it's really like, you know, you're in a bad state to begin with, just to be like ridiculed like that. It's kind of shitty.
That's a word for it, isn't it?
Thanks. Okay, so I think time's technically up, but if you, like I said, there's still the sheets up there. If you didn't grab them, it's just basic information. And if you want to talk it all after, just come up to me. But I hope this was helpful or just enjoyable to talk about, and that you all were able to walk away with something.
Thanks for talking. Thank you so much.
Thanks for all your input.
That's my favorite topic.